military, in their own studies in the 1970s, admitted that the primary reasons for bad discharge were racism on the part of the command or lack of education on the part of the enlistee.
Associating with the UN would have gained legitimacy. That's why I feel very skeptical that the United States is really not interested in democracy.
George Bush had the arrogance, had the gall to land on a carrier, trying to again build this image about being a great fighter pilot and trying to build an image for re-election.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, May 6, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. $1 billion taken from a bank in Baghdad shortly before the bombing began remains missing at this time. Treasury Department officials say they don't know where roughly $900 million that was removed from Iraq's central bank shortly before the U.S. began bombing Baghdad has been taken. The New York Times reported that Saddam Hussein ordered the money be taken from the central bank and sent his son Qasai to grab the cash in the middle of the night. According to the Times, the amount of money, $900 million in U.S. $100 bills and $100 million in euros, was so large it had to be taken from the bank in three tractor-trailer trucks. Retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner, described by critics as a governor-in-waiting in Iraq and faulted for his ties to the defense industry and his pro-Israel stance, has cobbled together a council of nine Iraqis to lead the country's interim government. According to the Associated Press, Garner predicts a nucleus of a temporary Iraq government will be in place by mid-May. Five Iraqi leaders who oppose the Saddam Hussein regime have been consulting over recent weeks, including the highly controversial Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress. Some Iraqi politicians proposed that a collective executive be formed, but Garner said he didn't know whether that would happen. Of the Iraqi presidency, Garner said, "I don't know if it will be one guy or five guys or three." He also said longtime State Department official L. Paul Bremer will take charge of the political side of the U.S. post-war administration. Though Iraq has the world's second largest untapped oil reserves, several weeks of U.S.-led heavy bombing has damaged the country's infrastructure such that making a routine trip to the gas station has become a difficult feat for many Iraqis. Raphael Kraft has more from Baghdad.
Majid is carrying 1,000 Pepsi Cola cans in his 25-year-old Chevrolet Caprice Classic. He drives as often as he can in between Amman and Baghdad. Although he is a mechanical engineer, this is the only way he found for his family to survive. Because the American Air Force bombed all the filling stations along the road between the Jordan-Iraqi border and Baghdad, he has hidden a gas tank in the middle of the no-man's land in between Iraq and Jordan. What are you doing, Majid?
I'm full my car benzene.
He means gas.
But where did you find the benzene? The benzene was hidden in the...
Under the tree. Because no benzene. After Iraq border... No benzene.
Before the war, Iraq's oil was among the cheapest in the world. Less than 50 cents a gallon for Majid's gas-guzzling Chevy. The situation is not better in Baghdad. The Al Dura refinery in the suburbs of the Iraqi capital is producing at a third of its pre-war capacity. The American army is guarding the compound.
First of all, I would like you to introduce yourself.
Sergeant Zachary from America, 82nd Airborne Division.
82nd Airborne, it means that it's a top division that is guarding the refinery.
We're helping secure the place, making sure nothing bad happens. Checking the vehicles that are coming in here, making sure they got no bombs or nothing coming through here, just for our safety and the people's safety, and guarding the refinery for Iraq. So,
is it a special security here as it is a refinery?
Yes, it is.
Unlike the employees, the director of the refinery doesn't want to talk to the press. Mohammed is a maintenance technician at the refinery. He came back to work 3 weeks ago. Mohammed says the refinery has not been looted and the shortage of electricity is the main reason why it is not producing at its maximum capacity. His salary before the war was $20 a month.
I received my salary before the war, but nothing since I returned to work. The famous $20 the American soldiers promised to the state employees have not yet been paid. Although I am not paid, I came to work as a patriot to serve my country. And besides, what would I do instead? There is no work anywhere in Iraq. The Americans have made promises, but we don't see any of them.
An American representative for Iraqi oil issues came to the refinery to ask employees what they needed to keep working, says Ahmed, one of the employees.
The most important we need is to avoid giving the decision-making jobs to the Ba'athists, the people representing the former regime. We do not want to work with these people. They are still here today. They occupy the same positions and they still treat us with bad manners.
Kids are at every street corner of Baghdad with jerry cans selling black market gas at 10 times the normal price. It's the only way for private car owners to avoid waiting hours in front of the filling stations. The shortage of gas, along with the absence of public transportation, makes it difficult for normal life to start again. Saad has been waiting since early morning to fill his tank. There is still a half a mile line of cars ahead of him.
This is a start from morning, from 7 o'clock in morning. We wait there about 5 hours to get a petrol or benzene for every day from the war is stopped. We think the American army may everything in Iraq service will be good, but this is opposite what we think.
The first tanker arrives at 11 o'clock at this filling station in the south of Baghdad. Mohamed Obeidi is the manager. His main concern is security. He says he cannot open the filling station until American soldiers arrive to control the distribution. At noon, there weren't any of them there yet.
There has been any problems here? Lootings? People with guns?
Yes, yes. You see that. If we're beginning the work, it has been very difficult and the problems. You see that.
Near the pumps, people get angrier and angrier. Some of them have spent the night in their cars to get their rations of gas. Some say, at least under Saddam Hussein, we did not have such problems. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft in Baghdad.
As the long-term occupation of Iraq begins, an unlikely group is among those Americans expressing concerns and frustrations over the plan and over the long-term foreign policy plans of the U.S., namely friends and family members of American servicemen and women. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Nancy Lesson of Military Families Speak Out.
Well, this is an organization that was formed in November by two families. Both of us had children who were in the military. In my case, my stepson Joe is in the Marines, and he had been deployed in August, and we were speaking out against an invasion of Iraq that we believe to be immoral and unjust and illegal. This organization, like I said, was founded in November with two families, and now here we are in the beginning of May, and we have over 500 families, mm-hmm. All with loved ones in the military. Mm-hmm. And these families are speaking out not only now about the invasion of Iraq, which unfortunately happened, we were seeking to prevent it, but speaking out about the foreign policy that allowed this to happen, the doctrine of preventive wars of aggression. It's our loved ones who are going to be involved in any subsequent actions, and we believe that the invasion of Iraq was unfortunately just the beginning. We're very concerned about this, so we're trying to prevent any future wars of aggression. Mm.
Well, the war at this point, the invasion of Iraq, is, according to the Bush administration, for all intents and purposes over. They've said the military phase is over. They can't quite say that it's formally over. Then they'd have to become formally an occupying force, and they'd have to release all the prisoners. But they're saying the military phase is over. And so you're still opposed?
Well, some of our loved ones are actually starting to come back, but others are just being deployed, and still others are still over there. So for those of us with loved ones in the military, this is far from over. What is very clear is not over is the policy that allowed this to happen, and that could now allow an illegal, immoral, and unjust invasion in Syria, Iran, name other countries. So we're very concerned about this. Mm-hmm. We're concerned both about our loved ones who will be the cannon fodder in these battles, and we're also concerned about the people of the countries where the invasions take place.
Well, some proponents of the war, some who say they support the troops and the president, have said, well, that wasn't so bad, was it? The infrastructure wasn't completely devastated. There weren't that many civilian casualties, and the people of Iraq have been liberated. What's your response to that?
Well, first of all, we'd say that certainly for those of us who lost loved ones and the Iraqi families who lost loved ones, that sentiment is not true at all. We're very concerned that our loved ones are going to come home. Those of us who are lucky enough to have loved ones come home, they're not going to be safe and sound once they're home. They've been exposed to everything from depleted uranium to battles where there could be emotional damage for the rest of their lives. We know from news reports, especially from other countries, that there were a tremendous number of civilian casualties and children who are left in hospitals that don't have adequate supplies. And we have concerns about what's going to happen in Iraq now and what's going to happen in the Middle East. We feel that the situation that we created in the Middle East could serve to destabilize the Middle East. We're concerned about potential of increased terror in this country because of what we have done in the Middle East. And we're very concerned about this new policy of preventive wars of aggression that we see as armed globalization. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. seeking to dominate a world in a way that is so opposed to anything that's moral and also opposed to international law. And again, I'll reemphasize that for those of us who have loved ones in the military, it is our loved ones who are going to be used as cannon fodder. Mm.
Nancy, your stepson, Joe, was he deployed to Baghdad?
He actually was deployed in August, went to Kosovo first, then he went to Djibouti and Bahrain and ended up in the Persian Gulf and went into Iraq.
What is his position about the war now?
Actually, my husband and I have been involved in military family speaking out, but we don't speak for Joe. He can speak for himself, and we make it a point to say that we speak for ourselves in this, but I can share with you that Joe knows everything that we're doing, and he tells us that he loves us. What I can say in a larger picture of Military Families Speak Out is that we're a very diverse organization geographically in terms of the area of service where our loved one is engaged in, and also in terms of who we are and who our loved ones are. In Military Families Speak Out, we include families who are longtime peace and anti-war activists who protested against the Vietnam War and the subsequent military actions. And we also have families who have never spoken out against a war, an invasion, or have not been active politically in any realm at all, who are speaking out for the first time against this invasion and the policies that allowed this to happen. Among our loved ones, we also have a diversity. We have some of our loved ones who are applying for conscientious objector status, and we also have loved ones who may be engaged in military operations, but absolutely agree with family members that this is really an illegal, immoral, and unjust war. Mm-hmm. We also have family members who support this policy, and we had one family where Loved one in the military stopped communicating with their family over the issue of the family speaking out against the war.
Mm. So what kind of response have you gotten from, say, your neighbors or other people throughout the community? Has it been favorable, supportive, combative, confrontational?
It's been mixed. Not among, you know, my personal neighbors in Boston, Massachusetts are very supportive and all have lawn signs opposing the war. In terms of our families and the responses that we're getting, it's everything from tremendous support, and I'd like to say that it's been wonderful working with this peace and anti-war movement locally and nationally. Military Family Speak Out has been warmly welcomed by the peace movement. We've been asked to speak from the stage at many of the major national demonstrations and rallies. We've been asked, along with Veterans for Peace and other veterans organizations speaking out against the war, to lead marches.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been really tremendous. We've also had some very serious and negative instances. Once my husband and I were standing at a rally, and we carry a sign. Actually, this was prior to the invasion. The sign said, our son is a Marine, and it had a picture of him, and it said, don't send him to war for oil. And a recent former Marine passed us and called us a disgrace to our son. We've gotten emails from people offering, wanting Joe's address and phone number because they want to take him away from us. They said, we're a family that can support him in what he's doing, and you obviously can't.
Nancy Lesson is the co-founder of the 500-member group Military Families Speak Out. Her stepson, Joe, is a Marine currently deployed in Baghdad. Today, the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln returned to port in Everett, Washington, after being deployed for 10 months. President-elect George Bush addressed the nation regarding the end of hostilities in Iraq from the deck of the Abraham Lincoln last week. For some veterans, the sight of George W. Bush landing on the aircraft carrier touched a sore spot.
George Bush had the arrogance, had the gall to land on a carrier, trying to again build this image about being a great fighter pilot and trying to build an image for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
And an image being a fighter pilot or of a war hero, which is a crock. It's literally a crock.
Lieutenant Colonel Bill Burkett. Although Bush's autobiography states he was a fighter pilot, his military record shows that through a disciplinary action, he lost his flying privileges and never served in combat. Last week, Peace Watch spoke with 28-year Army veteran Lieutenant Colonel Bill Burkett, who shares some little-known facts about how President-elect Bush came to be in the Texas National Guard.
George Bush wanted to join the Guard in May of 68. He came into the Guard prior to his graduation from Yale. He knew his draft number was up pretty close. And like all of us in those days, you were totally aware of your draft number and where you fit within your student deferment status and all of those things dealing with the draft board. You managed those pretty closely. He was about to lose his student deferment, and he made whatever decisions were necessary within his family and himself. And he was encouraged to get into the Guard. A member of the Bush family, George Herbert Walker Bush, was a congressman in Houston at the time, a good friend and luncheon person, I guess you would say luncheon friend of Congressman Bush's, contacted then Lieutenant Governor, and they contacted the Texas National Guard to try to get George W. moved to the top of the list, which they were able to do. There was a long waiting list of people trying to get into the Texas National Guard. George W. Bush had taken his aptitude tests, and he scored about a 25, I think it was. In fact, I know it was a 25 on his pre-flight test, and on whatever basis, whether it was friendship or whatever, he was moved to the top of the list.
So 25 out of a possible 100?
25 percentile, yes.
Okay.
Which is just at that time was at the absolute, absolute, absolute minimum.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm stunned. Usually, that's a failing mark.
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh. I just want to be clear.
The only reason that that would even be a consideration is, how did he get in the guard?
Yes.
And then secondly, how was he put at the front of the list? And then thirdly, how could they justify giving the man a direct commission? And please understand, a direct commission at that time and forevermore is almost always reserved for doctors, medical doctors that have already completed medical schooling. There's such a shortage of health care officials in the military services that they sometimes will take somebody that has completed medical school, and they'll direct commission them and make them a member of the National Guard or a member of the active component.
Now, direct commission, you mean he was just directed to become a part of the National Guard?
By signature, a general officer made him a second lieutenant. He didn't have to go through any prior training, any considerations. He didn't have to go through an officer candidate school or anything else. George Bush did not meet his contract. George Bush did not provide full service in that 17-month period. He gave 4 good years, or what are called good years of service, on a six-year contract, and there were other situations in which he was ordered to duty and he did not appear and did not, in fact, respond. That occurred in the Vietnam era.
Military records show that between the period of May 1972 through October 1973, Bush failed to report to duty. Burkett asserted that normally failing to report for duty would result in the arrest of the offender for the period of time they were absent from duty. And if they failed to conform, they would be discharged from the National Guard, drafted into armed services, and sent to Vietnam. During part one of our conversation, Burkett revealed a scam in the Texas National Guard to defraud the federal government of thousands of dollars under the leadership of then-Governor George W. Bush. Under the scam, the Texas National Guard continued to receive funds for former Guard members months and even years after they had left service. Texas National Guard continued receiving funds to which it was not entitled. Peace Watch asked Lieutenant Colonel Bill Burkett what led him to risk his career and take a stand for integrity by blowing the whistle.
I'm not one of these that's going to set myself up as a hero, because I'm not. My father was a preacher for 36 years. I was raised that you don't look at tomorrow to correct errors that you should have seen and corrected today. You saw them on the spot. I've lived a life that way, and it's often been destructive to us financially or otherwise. I mean, we all come to points in the road, and we have to decide whether it's the moral thing that has to guide us. It was wrong. It's just that. It's that quick, and it's that simple. It was wrong. And I made that determination, and I am that quick with those determinations. When it's wrong, I just simply won't do it.
Do you have any final thoughts on your part that you'd like to share with us?
There have been several things that have been very clear to me about our American system and about the way that we teach our kids in grade school. And I learned in grade school that you believe in the dream and that the system works. I've encountered a system which on the books said that all people would be treated fairly and equitably. And of course, we know that that doesn't happen. On the books, it says that the rich or the powerful or by position or by influence will not be able to have a leg up. But in this particular case, if you talk about George Bush's records or his entry into the Guard, you see that that's exactly what happened. We never, throughout the 6 years, nobody ever looked at what happened to the young person who wanted to be a good flight officer, and that once we invested $1 million in their training, would have stayed with the National Guard for 25 or 30 years, or with the active component, or would have fought in Vietnam. We never look at their loss of service or at what it does to impact their lives or their future. I've had a disappointment in that. I've had a bigger disappointment, though, in people who take what I consider a peeping Tom approach, and they come in and they take a capsule look at what's going on, and they say how tragic, and they want to deny and move on rather than solving the problem. The problems of this great country are growing. They are mushrooming. And they're mushrooming because people allow those problems to go unsolved each day and hope that somebody else will face them. And it starts with somebody finally saying, when they're told to change readiness reports, it starts by people saying, no, that's wrong. That's against the law. But it also has to have the support of those that are around them, who are willing to stand up and say, no, I know it puts my job a little bit in jeopardy, but I won't go along with it either. And that's where people like George Kahn, Lieutenant Colonel Dennis Adams, CW4 Harvey Goff gave their careers, all three of them did, and stood, and they stood against a sitting president in a court of law that went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, but they are three among 4,000 or 5,000 people that knew the details, but they were only three, and that's my disappointment.
28-year Army veteran Lieutenant Colonel Bill Burkett revealed a scam in the Texas National Guard to defraud the federal government of thousands of dollars under the leadership of then-Governor George W. Bush. Burkett was denied money for medical treatment by the government and his benefits for a life-threatening illness he developed while on tour of duty in Panama, which left him with a 60% loss of function on the right side of his body. On a lighter note, the Christmas Coup comedy players of Pacifica Station's KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York parody George W. Bush's domestic plan.
We take you now live to the Oval Office where Vice President Dick Cheney, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice are meeting via telephone with the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Hello, are you there, Mr. President?
Mr. President, have we lost you?
We've lost the president.
Right. Okay, now we have the president.
Mr. President?
Dick.
Oh, yes, we're here, Mr. President.
There,
we're worried about you.
What happened to my phone?
I don't know. We're afraid they blew up your remote location.
Question here.
Yes.
Did they blow up the Fatherland's Oval Office yet?
No, Mr. President.
Not yet, Mr. President. No.
Well, if you hear a missile approaching, close the window or something like that.
Yeah.
The window is closed, Mr. President.
Yeah, we thought of that.
That's good, kids.
Yeah.
Yes, thank
Here's
you.
What I want to tell you.
Yes, Mr. President.
Because of the success of our simple three-step war plan, kill enemy, inflict damage, and get rich, rebuilding their country, I have decided to employ the same war plan to take care of this country, the fatherland's domestic issues.
Well, that's a good idea, Mr. President.
How do you do that, Mr. President?
Listen to me.
Yes.
You guys listening?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Stay tuned.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Step one, dig this.
Yeah.
Kill the enemy.
Kill the enemy,
Step
yeah.
one.
Step one. First. Yeah.
First, we must identify the enemy.
You can't kill the enemy until you identify the enemy, Mr. President.
ID the enemy.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, high unemployment, tell me if I'm wrong, threatens our economy.
You are right. Yes, yes, it does, Mr. President.
Yes.
Thus, unemployment is the enemy.
Yes,
Mr. President.
Patriotic citizens will be encouraged to kill the unemployed until acceptable unemployment levels are achieved.
How would they kill them, Mr. President?
Kind of dumb, Dick.
Well?
With guns, stupid.
Guns,
Well, you know, that might be dangerous, Mr. President, people shooting guns.
We could set up killing zones in poor neighborhoods.
Well, that might do it.
Hmm. Yeah.
The homes of striking workers will be demolished by bulldozers.
Wait, that's step two. Limit damage.
Yeah.
Remember this.
Yeah.
High limit damage.
Yes, Mr. President.
Yes, yes.
Our friends in the construction industry will be offered lucrative contracts to rebuild America once all the nation's libraries have been leveled and the books burned.
Mr. President, you've not only won the war in Iraq, now you've saved the economy.
I know I have, Condi. It's because Jesus loves me.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.